Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a webinar, Does Board Law Matter After Loper Bright?, featuring Professor Samuel Stryker and Alex McDonald. Our moderator today is Karen Harned. Karen is president at Harned Strategies, LLC. For over 20 years, she has served as executive director of the National Foundation of Independent Businesses Small Business Legal Center, building it from the ground up. Karen is a recognized expert in small business issues, labor law, constitutional law, and federal regulation and the regulatory process. She has testified numerous times before the U.S. House of Representatives and U.S. Senate, and frequently appears on national media. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And I believe we may have lost Karen. So I will kick it over to Professor Stryker, who can maybe introduce the subject and speak a little about Loper Bright.
Yeah. I want to sort of discuss Loper Bright a little bit as a sort of table setting move. The Supreme Court, I think it was back in the early 80s, wrote Justice Stevens wrote a decision in Chevron, which was very influential until this Loper Bright decision. The Chevron case involved the issue of it was under the Clean Air Act. Justice Gorsuch's mother ran the Environmental Protection Agency at that time, and the issue in the case was whether or not a particular source, what was a source within the meaning of the Clean Air Act? Was the source the actual emitter of the problematic chemical, or the entire site which was engaged in the production of the chemical? The Supreme Court held, and I actually interviewed Justice Stevens about this, the Supreme Court held that the word source could mean both, could mean either the particular emitting source or the entire site, and said, you know, that the agency can choose between these two different interpretations of the word source. The opinion suggested, in the language the court used, that there's ambiguity, then the reviewing court ought to go with the agency's interpretation, as long as it's reasonable, you know, reasonably grounded in the facts and a reasonable interpretation. I always found Chevron problematic, because ambiguity is something that, first of all, it's in the eye of the beholden. You know, one man's ambiguity is another person's clarity and precision of expression. And secondly, courts are there to resolve ambiguities, not agencies. So it's a very strange ruling. It appeared to be a innovation in judicial review of agency interpretations. We're dealing with agency interpretations of law here, not so much facts. And so Chevron, you know, generated, you know, many, many decisions in the federal system, some decisions also in the state system. The problem with Chevron in practice is that courts used Chevron to avoid actually coming to grips with the statutory interpretation question. I don't think that was the intent of Justice Stevens. In fact, when I interviewed him, he said he didn't know why there was such a big noise about Chevron. Well, he wrote it in a way which created somewhat of a noise, but the courts were using it to basically abdicate their own role, which is to interpret questions of law. That was the problem with Chevron, and a good illustration of that is the case actually that led to Loper Bright, the case involving fishing vessels. And in certain fishing vessels, the United States created a regulatory system to prevent overfishing of certain waters. It had three programs where it provided, the statute had three programs where it provided for the vessels themselves to pay for the observers, but not with respect to East Coast vessels. And the courts of appeals said, well, it's ambiguous whether it applies to East Coast vessels. The agency had come up with a rule that said they too had to, the vessels there too had to pay for the observers, even though they weren't listed in the statutory list. We have a canon in the interpretation of statutes, exclusio unius. You have a statute that says you got to pay, the vessels have to pay for observers in these three situations, but not in that one. And the reviewing court said, oh, it's ambiguous. We're going to defer to the agency's rule. That's Loper-Bright. That's an example of a misuse of Chevron. In any event, the Supreme Court in Loper-Bright said, well, Chevron is wrong, wrongly decided. We resolve ambiguities. We interpret the statute. That's what the Administrative Procedure Act provides for. We interpret questions of law. We, the courts, interpret questions of law. The agencies may have a role in that process, but we have the final say on what statutes mean, even if there is ambiguity. And I think that is the holding of Loper-Bright. So it basically overturns Chevron, which, as I said, came up with this rule of strong deference to the agency as long as it's an ambiguous term. The court did leave open some areas where the you need to pay considerable respect, that was the language the court used, to the agency's interpretation, even on questions of law. So one example is where an agency has adopted an interpretation of the statute from the very beginning. There's also a Supreme Court decision on this point called Norwegian Nitrogen. A contemporaneous interpretation of the governing statute by the agency from the very beginning of its enactment, that is usually a strong lead on what that term means. That doesn't mean the court doesn't have the final say, but it's an area where in many, many situations, the Supreme Court and lower courts have recognized they have to have a good reason to overturn the agency's contemporaneous with enactment or contemporaneous with amendment interpretation. So let me call that the Norwegian Nitrogen Rule. A second situation is called Skidmore. An interpretation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. When is call time compensable under the Fair Labor Standards Act? It's an opinion by Justice Jackson, very well reasoned opinion. And that is a doctrine of respect, not of deference. Not the agency's interpretations are entitled to respect if the agency has consistently maintained that interpretation. And the agency's interpretation indicates that they have the better reasons given for its interpretation. In other words, it's soundly reasoned, consistently applied, consistently interpreted. That is Skidmore. Skidmore is still good law. So is Norwegian Nitrogen still good law. Then is a third area that I think the court carves out where the best reading of the statute is that the agency has been given interpretive authority over the term. I call this the Hearst rule, Hearst Publications, because the Supreme Court refers to Hearst Publications in this area. The Supreme Court in Hearst Publications, which I believe was a late 30s, 1930s decision, dealt with the definition of the word employee. What the court says is, look, Congress didn't want us to apply the common law. This is a new statutory scheme. The common law was based on tort law. When is the owner of a project liable for the misdeeds of employees or contractors? This is a very different context. These are business invitees, they're employees. They're business invitees at the very least. The question is, are they employees? And so the Supreme Court in Hearst said, you know, the common law doesn't apply here. There's a range here of interpretive delegation, if you will, the delegation or Hearst argument. Now, Congress actually disagreed with the Supreme Court and the NLRB's interpretation in Hearst and actually changed the statute in 1947 to provide for an express exclusion for independent contractors from the definition of employee, and also cited approvingly to legislative history, which said that we apply the common law test. So actually, even though Hearst is used as an example of permissible delegation in the Supreme Court's Loper-Bright decision, actually, it's a case where the Congress felt that the NLRB had gone too far in rejecting common law precedents. So those, I think, are the three exceptions to the basic rule. The basic rule is that the court, and ultimately the Supreme Court, has the final say on all questions of interpretation of law. They pay respect to the agency in certain circumstances. I've tried to outline what they are, and they will respect delegations in appropriate circumstances. And that's what I mean by the Hearst exception, if you will. Do you want to say more?
I think our moderator, Karen, is back and she's on mute.
Karen?
Well, while Karen starts to come off mute, thank you for that setup, Sam. And I think it really does frame up the issue around that's developing around the National Labor Relations Board, the agency we're specifically focused on today. I mean, so Loper-Bright, as Professor Stryker was laying out, I think was relatively clear on its face, and also relatively, it's hard to call an epic making decision like Loper-Bright modest, but as the way, when you start walking through Loper-Bright and its exceptions, it does leave a pretty substantial room for agencies to continue operating going forward. And so you might think that once we all had time to settle down and take a breath, that it wouldn't be as problematic or controversial in application as it might have seemed initially. But unfortunately, that hasn't worked out to be the case. It actually has turned out there are some really messy questions about even whether Loper-Bright applies at all. So look, I mean, The logic of Loper-Bright on space, Professor Stryker did a great job laying out, but there are some reasons that some folks, even before Loper-Bright came down and since the board itself has taken, to suggest that the case, the decision, whatever it may mean for your traditional executive agencies, actually doesn't apply to the Labor Relations Board. So that may, you know, be counterintuitive, but
what's the argument, Alex?
I mean, so yeah, let's talk about it a little bit. So Loper-Bright, formalistically, was about two things. It was about the Chevron decision, which itself was about the APA. How do we apply the standards of review under the APA? Now, Chevron is a little bit of an ironic decision because it doesn't even cite the APA, which was the governing statute. But that's how it has come to be understood. And so the argument is that, well, when most of the stuff that the board does that gets bubbled up to the courts of appeals isn't APA stuff. In fact, it is decisions that the NLRB is issuing in unfair labor practice proceedings. And so for folks who are new to this, this is how this works. Somebody files a charge against either an employer or a union that says you broke the labor law in X, Y, or Z reasons. That charge gets processed through an administrative process in front of an ALJ and then ultimately up in front of the NLRB. The NLRB issues a decision, but those decisions aren't self-enforcing. Either the board has to go to a court and petition for enforcement, or the aggrieved party, whoever the board found violated the law, petitions a court and says, well, I think the board got this wrong. That's how most of the stuff the board does gets in front of courts. And that doesn't come up through the APA. It comes up through Section 160 of the National Labor Relations Act. So just from a formalistic standpoint, somebody sitting in the board might say, well, you know, yes, you know, there's all this talk in Loper-Bright about, you know, this, you know, we don't defer to agencies, but that's about the APA. That's not really about us. Oh, and by the way, we have all this longstanding separate line of case law going back to the Hearst case, at least in 1944, which Professor Stryker was referencing, that says the board is due substantial deference when it is interpreting labor law. And the court didn't overturn any of that. So whatever you may think about Loper-Bright in the context of a traditional executive agency, we are so far unaffected. The court didn't overturn any of those decisions. Now, that's the argument. Whatever the merits of that view, it is not one the majority of the courts have been taking.
Alex, I can't hear you. Can't hear you, Alex.
We've had all kinds of technical
I know.
Can you guys hear me now?
Yes.
I can hear you now, Chris. Thank you.
Sorry about that. What I was saying was, you know, despite, I've laid out the view that the board has taken in a few amicus filings, and some people were suggesting even before the decision came down, but it's not the view that the majority of courts have taken so far. And so by my count, we have five circuits on record now that have addressed Loper-Bright in the context of the board. We've got the 4th, 5th, 6th, 10th, and then I'm setting the 3rd out of order because it's the only court that went the other way. The 4th, 5th, 6th, and 10th have all said Loper-Bright applies. We do not defer to agencies, including the board, on questions of law. Relatively straightforward application of Loper-Bright. The 3rd circuit sort of set this question off to the side and said, well, yes, you know, there are these arguments that the Loper-Bright wouldn't apply. We don't really need to address it in this case because we agree with the board's viewpoint. So, I mean, the clear trend here is, you know, toward applying Loper-Bright to the board. And if we need one more data point on this, I want to call out just last week on Friday, we got a decision in a case called FCC v. Consumers Research. This case was not about agency deference on its face. It was about non-delegation issues. There was an issue about the Universal Service Program, which the FCC runs. It was about whether Congress had given enough guidance to the FCC about how to run that. Court ultimately said that it did, wasn't a non-delegation problem. But the interesting part that I want to highlight was the concurring opinion that Justice Kavanaugh writes. And in that concurring opinion, he goes out of his way to talk about the role of independent agencies. I say he went out of his way because the FCC is not an independent agency. The members of the FCC don't have statutory removal protection, which is what we usually mean when we say independent agency. He writes that it would be more problematic if Congress had delegated this type of authority that Congress had given the FTC to an independent agency. And his rationale was that independent agencies are not directly accountable to any elected official because they have this, the heads of executive or independent agencies have this removal protection. So there's an accountability gap that he's concerned about. And his solutions to those two, to that issue, are two that he lays out that would be possible. One would just be to overturn a case called Humphrey's Executor v. FTC, was from the from 1935. Effectively, the court blessed these removal protections in the context of certain independent agencies. There's been a lot of discussion about Humphrey's Executor. That one, I don't think, would have surprised anyone. But the second solution to this accountability problem that Justice Kavanaugh sort of sketches out in Humphrey's Executor would be to apply a closer review from a judicial standpoint to the actions of independent agencies. What he says, you know, apply more teeth when looking at what they've done, apply a stricter version of something like the major questions doctrine, which is a rule courts use to decide, well, you know, we're going to just assume that Congress wouldn't have given the agency to do this because it's really important. It has broad social or economic importance. And what that means is, from Justice Kavanaugh's standpoint, what the board has been arguing about whether this Loper-Bright applies to it is actually opposite. It's not just wrong. It's diametrically wrong. Not only should the board not be getting deference because of its independent status, but it should actually get less deference from courts. So all of which is to say, it's pretty clear if you're sitting in a court of appeals at this point where the trend is going, should the board get deference on questions of law notwithstanding Loper-Bright? The answer seems to be pretty clearly no. I'm going to pause there and see if Karen had any questions she wanted to interject. But I do think we should talk about this issue, not just from the standpoint of courts who are looking at it, but from the board's standpoint. Like, how should the board be thinking about its own?
Alex, can I just interject for a moment? I think this argument about the APA not applying is nonsense. There are a number of times the Supreme Court has cited, referenced the APA in the review of NLRB decisions. I just think it's nonsensical. So I don't know if that helps. The SEC is functionally an independent agency because the Supreme Court in the Public Company Accounting Board assumed that they could only be removed for cause, even though it doesn't say that in the statute. That's the Public Company Accounting Board. The Supreme Court held there was a double for cause protection and included the SEC. So I just a clarification there. But I don't know what Justice Kavanaugh is talking about. Under Loper-Bright, there's a great deal of review of questions of law. I mean, you're going to have more review on the multi-member agencies, but I'll have to read his opinion. Humphrey's executor, if you want, we can talk about it later on. That's really important.
I think they have mispronounced the agency. It's the FCC, not the
SEC. I'm sorry.
FCC was the agency that's at issue in Consumers Research.
I see.
Yeah, the SEC is an independent agency, for sure. As the statute's been interpreted, as we say.
Good.
So actually, Sam, I want to start with you on that. So do you think then that there is uncertainty about how Loper Bright applies to the board? Do you think that is in question?
There should be no uncertainty about it. And sounds like the courts agree with me at this point. Mm-hmm. The APA applies to all agency action unless it falls within one of the exceptions. It doesn't apply to what the president does. The Supreme Court has made that clear, president's actions, but it applies to all agencies unless there's an exception. So I don't see the argument. And there've been, as I said, there've been Supreme Court decisions expressly referencing the APA in NLRB cases.
Go ahead, Alex.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to, it's the correct point, but even beyond that, I mean, the sheer logic of Loper Bright, even if we didn't have APA authority applied to the board already throughout its history. And look, the board engages in rulemaking occasionally, and the APA obviously applies to challenges to its rulemaking. So I think the point is right. The only thing I'll say is the very logic of Loper Bright, setting aside this APA issue, suggests that courts ought to be reviewing questions of law de novo when they get them from the board, just as they do from any other agency, because the logic is at bottom this, that it is the job of courts, not of administrators, to interpret law. Otherwise, well, what are the courts doing, right? That is ultimately their role. Now, agencies have throughout history had different ancillary roles to that. I mean, agencies have long had a role going back to like the ICC, in developing factual records. There's a longstanding appellate model where the agency creates a record and applies legal standards to the record, which can sometimes be framed as quasi-legal, quasi-factual decisions. But on pure questions of law, it is a distinction without a difference to say that most board decisions are coming up through the 160 process as opposed to a pure APA action. So, but I agree with Professor Stryker, and all the courts that have come in on this issue also agree. This should be a settled issue. I only flag it and discuss it because it is an argument that has been made and continues to be made in court filings by the board.
So assuming that it applies, how much of what the board does is interpreting law and how much of it is exercising discretion, which Loper Bright suggests is still possible?
That's a tough question. It's going to depend on the particular case. So if you think about a lot of decisions can also be the application of an existing rule to a state of facts. Sometimes that involves a legal limitation on the board, and sometimes it doesn't. Let me give you an example. I think it's a case called Amazon, which is in Attorney General, and sorry, the Association for a Cooperative Workplace. Is that the name of the organization, Alex? Democratic Workplace.
I'm sorry,
the case is Home Depot, not Amazon. Home Depot involved a ruling by the NLRB that an employee is protected in wearing a BLM, a Black Lives Matter, I don't know if it was a decal or whatever, but it was inconsistent with the uniform policy of Home Depot. And the board held that this particular, even though this was just a single employee, and it wasn't clear that other employees were joining in, because the statute only protects protected concerted activity. A single employee wearing this button, inconsistent with the uniform policy of the company, but it related back, according to the board, it related back to prior discriminatory incidents, racial discriminatory incidents. Now, you know, we can turn that into a question of law by saying, you know, It was still, it's a single person. There was no evidence that any other employee engaged into it. So there's a kind of question of law there, but there's also a question of application of law to fact in that particular circumstance. So some of those cases are going to, because the court had made clear in Lopez-Bry, this is own, its ruling is limited to questions of law, questions of statutory interpretation. But, they're going to be hard cases. The characterization is not going to be that simple. So another case is where the board, the NLRB, I think it's called Thrive. I didn't see the I in there. So Thrive. Thank you very much, Alex. And the question is, how far is the board's remedial authority? The board in that case held that the remedial authority of the board extends beyond back pay and front pay to also include collateral damages. So for example, because you've been fired, you no longer can maintain your health insurance. Is that within the make-whole remedy, the equitable remedy of the NLRB? We can frame that as a legal question. I'm not sure it is. I'm not saying it's rightly decided, and there are Seventh Amendment constitutional problems with the board engaging in imposing non-restitutionary damages beyond back pay and front pay. So there might be that Seventh Amendment issue there, but the board historically has had a lot of discretion in forging remedies. So you'd have to find a real legal constraint. Maybe the Seventh Amendment is that constraint. So my point here, in answer to your question, Karen, in many cases we can find there is a question of law, and the board's interpretation is entitled to respect if it's been consistently held, if there's been a reasonable process of explanation. But in other cases, there may be questions of fact or application of law to fact.
Yeah, no, I think Thrive is a really great example of this. And just to put another pin in this, so the language in the statute, when we're talking about is the best reading of the statute, that's the standard from Loper-Bright, the best reading of the statute that the agency has some discretion, that it can move between the walls. In the statute, the NLRA says the board shall take affirmative action necessary to advance the policies of the law. Right. And then it gives one example. It gives back pay. And the question is, what else does the board have the authority to impose? There's one way to read that and say, well, affirmative action, we could do this sort of historical, plain meaning, originalist statutory analysis, say, well, affirmative action in 1935 and X, Y, and Z. Or you could read the statute and say, what this is a delegation of discretion over what kinds of action are going to promote the policies of the act. So that ultimately, from a liberal rights standpoint, is the legal question a court has to answer. Has the agency been given discretion in this area? And what are the outer bounds of that discretion? That's where the court's job is. And if you follow Loper-Bright by its logic, this part in the middle is what the agency still gets to decide. So there are clearly some other affirmative actions the agency can take, but can it, for example, impose what look like common law damages, consequential damages? That would be problematic for the reasons that Professor Stryker's glancing at, which is, we have a case called Jarchese from the 2024 term, which said, if you're imposing common law style remedies through an administrative process, this can potentially be a Seventh Amendment problem. Another good example is the example that Professor Stryker already raised during this call, which is Hearst. Right. So Hearst involved whether somebody is a quote unquote employee under the act. Now, the act has a really elliptical definition of employee. The way it ends up defining employees through a whole bunch of carve outs. Right. We said it shall not include people who are supervisors. It shall not include the employees of public entities. It shall not include independent contractors, which was added in the Taft-Hartley Act. That's an interesting example because worker classification ends up breaking down into two parts. Right. So one is the legal standard. Like, what's the rule we're applying when we're trying to figure out that somebody is or is not an employee? And then there's, is this person an employee under that standard? The latter half of that question is notoriously fact heavy. So you're looking at who provides the equipment. Does this person have a fixed schedule? Who's giving this person the orders? How are they paid? Are they paid by the job? Are they paid by the hour? Those are all facts, right? Whereas the legal standard, like what things are we going to look at, has traditionally been considered a question of law. Now, this was a point of debate early on in the Act's history. We had the Hearst case, and then with Taft-Hartley, Congress came in and said, wait a second, you know, when we said employee, we meant common law employees. I mean, effectively what they did was they added independent contractor to the statute, which the court interpreted to mean the same thing. All of which is to say, this is still an area where part of the answer is, this is a job for courts. What test do we apply when we're deciding that somebody is or is not an employee? And part of it is inherently and necessarily a factual question or a mixed question where right. The board is going to have to take that standard and apply it to some individual person and say, well, who gave you your orders? What does your contract say? You have to show up at a certain time. There's no way to avoid that the board still has some leeway when answering those questions. Otherwise, we're just going to have a trial de novo every time an appeal comes up from a court or from a board decision. So I agree. We're in wild agreement here on this call. This is a messy question, and it depends on what issue we're looking at. But at least the mental framework, I think, has been clarified by Roper Bryant.
I think it's salutary as well, because, you know, the board, at least with in 90% of the cases, the board is unanimous because they are just fact specific cases. Who did what to whom? Who said what to whom? That sort of thing. And why they say it, why they do it, why they fire this person, for example, why they discipline this employee. In those cases, the board is unanimous. It basically affirms the administrative law judge's decision. And it goes to the Court of Appeals, where it's summarily affirmed, just in a list of summary affirmances, no opinion. But in 10% of the cases, or in 15% of the cases, there are controversial policy moves being made. That's where the disagreement is. I think that Loper Bright creates an incentive for the agency to do a better job explaining why it has changed. I call this policy oscillation. I should have trademarked that term. I'd be a very rich man today, but I didn't. Where the board, basically, just because there's a change in administration, they're going to change the rule. And this creates enormous problems in terms of the administration of the statute and giving advice. You give advice to a client to not do X, Y, or Z, and they want to say, why should I restrain myself when the board might change its mind? And so it really is a very problematic thing. One thing we're trying to do with we have a proposal for a labor court is to curb some of this policy oscillation. But I think Loper Bright actually requires the board to do a better job of explaining what it is doing, because otherwise it's just going to be slammed into courts of appeals.
Which that gets into a question I had for you both. In light of Loper Bright, and we have seen, as Sam says, just every time you get a new administration, it's like a 180, right? And so do you think we'll see less of that at the board in light of Loper Bright?
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It's hard to say. Right now, the board is not even fully constituted. I think it would require a change in the mindset of unions and companies. And that's one reason why we're urging a labor court. So there's some curbing of this policy oscillation. But if in fact there is no change and there's a Democratic president next time around, they're going to want to overturn whatever Trump precedents there are. We don't know if there are going to be any Trump precedents, because the president is keeping alive Biden presidents, because he has not appointed a full board. But if he does, and there are these various Trump 2 precedents, and nothing changes in the mindset of both labor and management, then and with respect to these 15% cases, these policy cases, we might see a continuation of this process. But ironically, because of what's happening, I think, on the Humphreys executor side. I don't know if you want me to talk about this, Karen.
But yeah, I was going to go to that next.
Okay, maybe
I can
bring it up. Humphreys executor, I think, was a 1935 or 1937 decision. It was a unanimous decision written by one of the four horsemen, Justice Sutherland, for the Supreme Court, and basically sustained the constitutionality of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, an independent agency. The court used reasoning that may not make a lot of sense. It said the agency is not actually a purely executive agency because it performs some quasi-judicial functions. I think we've talked about agency adjudications earlier. And it also performs some quasi-legislative functions. And for that reason, it was not a purely executive agency. So basically, Humphrey's executor created a green light for all of the New Deal agencies, these multi-member agencies, that they were not exercising executive power. They're exercising something else. I think former President Hoover, who was in charge of the Hoover Commission, called it the headless fourth branch, because it's like a fourth branch that doesn't respond to anyone in a certain sense, at least in that terminology. Now, Humphrey's executor is up for grabs for a number of reasons. One reason is, well, I could just say that the Supreme Court seems to have made clear recently in dealing with a case involving President Trump's removal of the agency members of the Merit Systems Protection Board. That's a largely adjudicatory agency. It has some executive functions. President Trump removed them without cause before the expiration of their term. And President Trump also, in the case of the NLRB, removed one of the board members, Gwen Wilcox, without cause before the expiration of her term. And the Supreme Court has not decided whether these removals are proper. They go against the removal protections in these statutes, in the statute that set up the Merit System Protection Board and in the NLRA, the Wagner Act, as amended, that sets up the NLRB. However, the court agreed that these folks cannot be reinstated to their jobs on the emergency docket. It agreed they cannot be reinstated to their jobs. And the court says expressly, this is six members of the court, I believe, says expressly that they exercise considerable executive power. That's debatable, by the way, but that's what they said. And therefore, the government has shown probable success on the merits, which is one of the requirements for a preliminary injunction. Or put differently, the district courts and the courts of appeals lacked probable success on the merits for their determination that these folks should be reinstated in a preliminary injunction. Now, the court does say in that per curiam opinion that we are not deciding necessarily the ultimate question, but the ultimate question has to be governed by something we said in a case called Sela Law. Sela Law, forgive me for all this background, but I think you need it. Sela Law is an Elizabeth Warren creation. She created the Consumer Financial Protection Board, treating it as an independent agency. As Alex pointed out, removal protections connote you're an independent agency, but it only has a single head. It's not a multi-member agency, it's a single head agency. So there are no opposing views to the current head of the Consumer Financial Protection Board. So the Supreme Court in this case, which is called Sela Law, in an opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts, I think he's a very important player here, held that the single member agency, independent agency, is problematic for lots of reasons with which I agree, but it also stated that we've only recognized two exceptions to the unlimited removal authority of the president. One exception is for people that are inferior officers of the United States who have limited roles. And the other exception is for multi-member agencies that do not exercise significant executive power. So the language in the per curiam order in the NLRB and MS Merit System Protection Board suggests they've already decided this question. Maybe not. They say we're not deciding into which of the two categories only that we recognized in Sela Law. So I just did a piece about dealing seriously with Humphrey's executor. Because Humphrey's executor, I don't like to make short-term predictions. I make long-term predictions. I will tell you what's going to happen 30 years from now. And the reason I'm willing to make long-term predictions is I will not be around when you invalidate my prediction. But short-term predictions are problematic. But I'm making a short-term prediction right now. Humphrey's executor is not long for this world. Even though it's possible for the court to say, you know, we really look hard at the NLRB, they don't have significant executive power. In fact, if they have any, we'll just strip it from the statute. So, for example, the NLRB does have the authority to decide whether to seek a 10J preliminary injunction, but they historically delegated it to the general counsel. General counsel is now a presidentially removable position. The board also theoretically has overall responsibility for representation case determinations. As Alex pointed out, there are two basic things that the agency does. One is decide unfair labor practices. They're called C cases. And the other is decide elections. What's going to be the unit for the election? What adjudications over the conduct of the election, that sort of thing. Was there some misconduct that occurred? Those are our case determinations. Under the statute, the five-member agency, the board, has responsibility over those our case determinations. Historically, they've delegated it to the general counsel. So if you really look at it, unless you treat any role in law enforcement as executive, you know, you could argue they don't have significant executive authority. They have rulemaking. Once again, I've advocated rulemaking from the very beginning of my career. The problem with rulemaking in practice is that we now have this injunction practice of the district court. So you promulgate a rule and within minutes it's enjoined. Now we have all this litigation over the injunction. So the board has grown chary, C-H-A-R-Y, I think that's how it's spelled, chary of rulemaking. So our proposal, Roger King and David Sherwin and I have advocated, is we just shear all these so-called executive functions from the agency and treat the agency as a purely adjudicatory body. That may or may not work. We think it's the only possible course if the NLRB is to continue. And we think there's a strong, and I would argue, public interest and employer interest in continuing the NLRB. I'm willing to discuss that if you'd like. I know some people don't want the NLRB, but they don't have the NLRB. They're going to end up with, in my view, private rights of action. State law is all over the place, non-preempted, because Taft-Hartley preemption drops out. Many states allowing unlimited recognitional picketing, secondary boycotting. I think that the employers will come to rue the day. I think many of them understand this, even though they'd like to curb the power. So Humphrey's executor, I would say, is not long for this world. Alex, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, Alex, what about that? And also about if you think if there's going to be a change in the swing that we see between administrations.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, Humphrey's executor was not long for this world, even before the Supreme Court issued that emergency docket order. There was a case called Arthex from a few years ago, also written by Chief Justice Roberts. Didn't have anything to do with the board, didn't have anything to do with Humphrey's executor specifically. But what Chief Justice Roberts writes in that opinion is, and he's rejecting the argument that what the patent judges in that case were doing was not executive. And what he says is, well, hold on a second. They're in an executive agency. If you're in an executive agency, everything you do is executive. Otherwise, you shouldn't be doing it, which suggests that the fundamental logic underneath Humphrey's executor, which is some things that these independent agencies are doing are quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial so they can be insulated, is wrong because they are being done by executive agencies. Either it is an executive function or should sit somewhere else. You know, as soon as on top of all the opinions that Sam has already referenced, you know, there's the CFPB case, Seal of the Law, there was the PCAOB case that was free enterprise. This is the writing has been on the wall about Humphrey's executor. That being said, it's not dead yet. So we do have to think about what a world might look like where the removal protections survive. I think that's highly unlikely, but it's also impossible to answer your first question without thinking about Humphrey's executor, because just the very fact of turnover at the board could affect the turnover in policy. But just like circling back to how Loeb Wright does and should affect this, there's a practical answer and there's a theoretical answer. The theoretical answer is that it should, in fact, increase continuity over time in the interpretation of the law, because the idea is that now courts are going to be issuing all of the authoritative interpretations of the NLRA. The NLRB itself is getting no deference. And so, look, I mean, judges have lifetime appointments, which in and of itself, if all your legal interpretations, the rules that you're applying in these cases coming down are coming from courts, that in and of itself will slow down what Sam has coined as the policy oscillation. That's the theoretical answer, right? Just as a model, that's how it should work. As a matter of practice, look, we've already talked about how messy some of these questions can be, how you can squint at something and portray it as a policy decision or as a discretionary decision, in which case, if you have a really determined board that comes in and is unified around a view that it wants to move labor policy in another direction, it's very hard to stop that from happening. Because even if the board is ultimately rejected in court, there's a period of years that it takes these cases to actually percolate up to the courts of appeals. Just a single case can take more than a year to get through this unfair labor practice charge process, get a decision from the board, and then get up to a court. And beyond that, the board has a longstanding policy, which is called non-acquiescence, which Sam is extremely familiar with. He wrote the authoritative law review article on it. Is effectively, I'm going to simplify it here, and Sam's going to squirm, but it's just the board saying we're going to apply our own version of the law, not what the courts have said. Now, there are subversions of this. Many agencies practice some version of non-acquiescence, but the most aggressive version, the one the board's been criticized about, is what's called intra-circuit non-acquiescence, which is where you have a decision. Let's just say the Third Circuit issues a decision. It says, we think this part of the NLRA means something else. And the board says, well, okay, but you're just a circuit court. You only sit over Pennsylvania and New Jersey. We sit over the entire country. And we have been given authority by Congress to develop national labor policy. So we don't really care what you said in that other case. We're going to keep applying quote unquote board law until the Supreme Court, tells us something different. That's the most aggressive version of it. And that's really hard to justify now after Loper Bright. It was hard to justify beforehand. I mean, there was many, many folks who said that this was an improper practice. But after Loper Bright, I mean, the answer is the court says what the law is. It's the agency's job to follow it. And by the way, I mean, the way the board usually justified this practice, to the extent it ever even bothered to justify or acknowledge it was doing it, was to say, well, we need uniformity. Right. We have to have one labor law throughout our operations. We have to have a rule that we're applying consistently. Sometimes we don't know which court is going to review our decisions. And so we are just going to follow our own rule until we have another national body, the Supreme Court of the United States, say that our rule is wrong. Justice Roberts addresses a version of this argument in Loper Bright. The government was defending Chevron as a sort of a pro-uniformity precedent. It allowed agencies to develop policy uniformly geographically. And Justice Roberts rejects that. And what he essentially says, I'm going to paraphrase here, is that it is no value to have uniformity when you've got the law wrong. It is better to at least have the right legal answer in some places than to have the wrong answer everywhere, which, play that out to the non-acquiescence defense. There is no value in consistency across the administrative level when the courts have said that the law is different. And frankly, I will say, just from a policy standpoint, practical standpoint, the uniformity rationale behind non-acquiescence is illusory. Because you don't actually have quote unquote uniformity. What you have is, instead of horizontal disuniformity, you have horizontal uniformity and vertical disuniformity. I'll be more specific. The only people who can get the benefit of the interpretations that courts have handed down are the people who can afford to appeal to court. Everybody else at the administrative level is stuck with the board rule. That's not a uniform solution. That is a choice to make disuniformity at a different level, vertically instead of horizontally.
Alex, could I interject?
Of course.
First of all, I want to just draw a distinction between intra-circuit and inter-circuit. The NLRB has a broad venue choice, not only where the employer is doing business, where the action occurred, and also the D.C. Circuit. It's problematic to me for one circuit to say this is the law and you have to follow it everywhere else, because the circuit has a limited reach, limited geographic reach. It's also a reason the Supreme Court in the early 80s in the United States versus Mendoza held that you can't assert non-mutual collateral estoppel against the government. You have a limited reach. The uniformity will come from it getting to the Supreme Court. And secondly, the Supreme Court needs percolation among the circuits to find out of the 7,000-8,000 petitions out there, which cases to hear. So in the inter-circuit context, I think the board is justified. Or any agency is justified. It's no different than President Trump right now saying, this is something I've written about as well, that I'm not going to follow what these various circuits say on birthright citizenship because I have a different view. Now, I know that's the president's action, but the same argument was made by Sotomayor. You know, the circuits are in disagreement with you. You shouldn't be non-acquiescing. The answer is maybe you have power within your regional bounds in some circumstances. Now, the view we took, and former Dean Revesz and I of the NYU School of Law, is that with respect to intra-circuit non-acquiescence, that is more problematic. And the only time the board can do that is when it is actively seeking cert, setting it up for the court. If it's just flouting, now here's the problem. In the Social Security context, you cite this in your article, these were people that were advocates for the Social Security disability recipients. The Second Circuit had a rule, the treating physician rule, that you have to give conclusive deference to the treating physician. And I think we all know from our own experience that we can pick our lawyer and we can pick our doctor. So the Social Security Administration said we can't give it's a factor, but we have independent people deciding these issues. We hire independent physicians to decide whether you have a disability that allows you to get Social Security before your time, as it were. So that was what the issue was. And the Second Circuit wanted to sort of put clamps on the Social Security Administration. Now, by the statute, the uniformity is set up by the statute. We've got one agency, the Social Security Administration, taking it away from the NLRB. If they're actively setting it up for Supreme Court review, we don't think that is a source of censure even there. It's hard for me to understand why the Second Circuit has the ability to decide this issue for the Social Security Administration across the board. And I don't think Loper-Bright changes that.
Yeah. And do you have any chance? We did get a question on whether how the universal injunction case from Friday might play into this. Alex, you want to take that too? Because the point they make is, doesn't that decision allow the executive to bring a case in conflict with a given district court decision?
You know, that's actually an interesting one. I haven't given a lot of thought to that case in the board context. I would think in most litigation involving the board, it's not going to play a really substantial role because the way these things get teed up is they involve appeals or petitions for enforcement or petitions for review by individual parties, right? So usually you're not asking an individual or a court to issue widespread injunctive relief. Now, in some litigation around the board's regulations, you might see this come up, right? So maybe somebody's asking for broad universal relief from a board regulation. But even then, I would think that CASA has a relatively limited impact on board litigation because those kinds of actions, the regulatory actions, are going to be governed by the APA. And in CASA, there's a footnote, I think it's footnote 10, where Justice Barrett carves out the APA question.
Right.
Says, look, the APA, the language of the APA is that the court shall set aside any rule it finds inconsistent with the law or failing one of the other APA standards. And there's really only one rule to set aside, right? So it seems to present a logically separate question as to whether a court has general equitable jurisdiction under the Judiciary Act to issue injunctive relief that runs to the benefit of people who are not in front of it. So this is a hot take. We've had this decision in our laps for a couple of days. My initial thought is that this won't have a great deal of impact on NLRB litigation specifically. It's obviously an important case. I just think in this specific context, the application is probably relatively narrow.
Well, it's possible for a court to say, this is going to be the rule across the country. We're going to join you. Now you're saying that the APA I don't know if that APA language applies to adjudicatory decisions. I'd have to look at it more closely. It applies to rules for sure. I don't know of APA decisions on adjudications. I'd like to actually take a look at it more closely, but I think it's possible, you know, in a 10J injunction and we're going to enjoin the company across the country. I think we can see some of that. And even in the courts of appeals. Look, the problem is you have disagreement among the circuits, disagreement among the district courts, and the NLRB has statutory authority to administer the statute, whether it's appointed by a Republican president or a Democratic president. And there's a limited reach of these court decisions. Just because the court says you're wrong here, there are many examples of the Supreme Court taking cases and disagreeing with circuits in NLRB cases.
If I may, Sam, I completely agree that there are some instances in which there's real difficulty about what the board should do. For example, I mean, look, the very just geographical, physical fact that the board has jurisdiction over a whole country and a court has jurisdiction over a limited geographic span creates problems. And so does the board statute, which offers multiple options for review. Right. It can be where a party does business. It can be the D.C. Circuit. It can be where the ULP. So in some cases, there is legitimate confusion or uncertainty about which court will be reviewing the case. So in those cases, the board has to make a choice. And the question is, like, in these edge cases, how should the board be making that choice? Should it be doing what most nationwide entities do? For example, a company operating in multiple states does, and make a predictive judgment to look at the courts, to look at the decisions we have on the books, and say, well, what is the likely answer given that we have several courts that have weighed in on this issue, maybe even one? How have courts read the law? Should the board just follow that view and act like any other party in front of the court, that is to accept the court's opinion? Or does the board still have some leeway to make its own law? Say, well, you know, we don't know the Third Circuit or the Second Circuit, whichever circuit we're talking about, is going to review this decision. So we have a gap to fill. We're going to use our own rule. I think there's a real argument that after Loper-Bright, the board can't do the latter. What the board ought to be doing is making a predictive judgment about what the law is going to be as announced by courts, as opposed to just making up its own brand of law. That I think is still on the table and would change the way the board operates in many cases. I mean, I think one of the things you're going to notice if you are new to labor practice and you've been practicing in another area and you come start reading board decisions, you're going to say, well, it doesn't seem to be a lot of court decisions cited in this. Seems to be a lot of NLRB decisions cited. What if the court said about this? And you wouldn't know just by reading a board opinion, because the board's practice is to follow its own law unless it is compelled to do so in a situation where there's an obvious court to review the case and it has decided the issue the other way. I think that practice is harder to justify after Loper-Bright.
If I may interject, the board is not making its own law. It has policy decisions it's making. Some of them are unreasonable. Some of them conflict with external limits on the board's discretion. But you don't want Article III courts dealing with this minutia. On the non-acquiescence side, if in fact the board is not acting in a serious way to get this case to the Supreme Court, then I would agree with you. But there's no reason why, you know, a BLM logo is going to be allowed in one circuit and not another circuit. That should be resolved. Now, sometimes I think it's a matter of policy and respect the agency should have for the courts. They should acquiesce, unless in fact it's a serious policy decision and they're taking it all the way. So it shouldn't be willy-nilly. There I agree with you, Alex. But the agency has a national responsibility. There are Republican circuits. There are Democratic circuits. They're going to split on these issues. And that's why I use the treating physician rule, just to show you this is not an NLRB issue. There are issues of sound administration of a statute. Congress set up an agency. It didn't assign it to the Article III courts. Setting up an agency is to take advantage of their getting, you know, expertise, if you will, through experience. having these fact determinations made outside the Article III courts. So again, the board should show respect if, unless it's actively engaged in pursuing a national resolution of an issue, they should certainly acquiesce where it's likely to end up in that circuit. I've always believed that. The question is, you know, there are going to be cases where that's not the case. And there, I think the courts go beyond their sphere in enjoining the agency.
Alex, do you want to respond? And then we're going to need to close out because we're at the top of the hour.
Absolutely. I appreciate the point. In the case of a true circuit split, it is very difficult. And as Sam says, much of what the board does is policymaking. But there are cases in which it is very clear which court will be reviewing the decision. And in those cases, the board, even though there are options, like the DC Circuit always has jurisdiction. And if the DC Circuit has said something that is flatly opposite to the board's rule, very hard to justify, especially after Loper Bright applying a different brand of the law.
Great. Well, I appreciate you both today. And I apologize that my power went out right as we went live. So that was great. But I would be remiss, as we're about to celebrate the 249th year of freedom in America, if I did not thank Alex, who is a U.S. Air Force veteran and served in Operations Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom, for his service to our country. And I also want to thank Sam, who is a very esteemed law professor and also practitioner, great blend. In the labor space. We really had great experts, and I appreciate everybody joining us today and wish you a happy 4th of July.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, fans.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.